Tony Accardo was the official boss of the Chicago outfit for only 10 years, but in reality, he helped run the organization for decades. I'm Brian McCoy. Welcome to The Mob Files. Okay, everyone, welcome into episode 4 of The Mob Files. Today, our subject is Tony Accardo, who in my opinion is one of the most interesting mob figures in history. He was a top voice in the Chicago outfit for more than 30 years, and he also has an interesting connection to the National Football League, but more on that later. Tony Accardo was born on April 28, 1906 in Chicago. His family had moved to America from Sicily shortly before he was born, and like the subject of every episode so far, Accardo got involved with crime very early on, joining a street gang at 14. This isn't really all that surprising when you think about it. We're talking about recent immigrants to the country. They didn't speak the language and were not widely accepted here. This made it difficult for them to find good paying work, and this often meant that the children had to leave school early and start working to help make ends meet. This also made them easy targets for adult criminals who wanted to bring new members into the fold. They knew they could prey on these people because they were looking for economic opportunities. This is exactly what happened with Accardo. With his parents' permission, he left school at 14 and went to work in a delivery service. But shortly thereafter, he was recruited by a local gang and he got involved. Now, the gang was mainly involved in robbery and theft, relatively small-time stuff. But he stood out amongst his peers and caught the eye of Jack Machine Gun McGurn, one of Al Capone's top men. Capone's Chicago outfit was engaged in a brutal war over territory and needed bodies. Accardo was soon brought into the Chicago outfit. This was right around the time that Prohibition started. Capone had become boss of the organization in 1925, but he was second in command in the early 20s and helped the organization establish its bootlegging operations. The outfit allegedly made $100 million a year at its peak selling illegal booze. That's more than $1 billion in today's money. Due to how profitable bootlegging was, there was obviously fierce competition to grab pieces of the pie. And during the early 20s, hundreds of mobsters were killed in Chicago fighting over territory. At some point in the 20s, while he was still very young, Accardo became an official member of the outfit, and it didn't take long for him to catch the eye of Capone. Capone tasked Accardo, amongst others, to take care of some outfit members who had tried to make a move against him. Accardo allegedly hunted down the men and beat them to death with a baseball bat. When Capone heard this, he apparently chuckled and said that Accardo was a, quote, real Joe Batters. And just like that, one of Accardo's two iconic nicknames was born. This is beside the point, but I think Accardo had the most interesting nicknames of any mobster. The first, Joe Batters, which you just heard the explanation for, and Big Tuna was the second one. Apparently, this stems from an incident where Accardo caught a huge 400-pound tuna on a fishing trip in Florida and posed for a picture with it. But the important takeaway from this event is that Accardo was able to score big points with Capone very early on. He would go on to serve a number of roles for Capone, including working as a driver at one point. This may not seem like a huge deal at first, but if you research mob figures and families, you'll realize that driving for the boss means that you are well on your way to a prominent position. One great example of this is Nicholas Savella, who drove for the boss Tony Gizzo in Kansas City before taking on the top job himself after Gizzo's death. You know, like I said, it doesn't make sense at first glance. Why would being a driver for someone equate to you moving into a prominent position yourself? But if you think about it, a high-ranking mob figure would only let someone drive if they really trust him. The driver's going to know the comings and goings of this person, they're going to hear a lot of important conversations, they're going to know who they're meeting with and when, and so they would only put someone in there that they really trusted, and it says a lot that Capone trusted Accardo for that job. The other big takeaway from the Joe Batters incident was that Accardo was not afraid to get violent. I think it's safe to say that Capone or any boss of a criminal organization needs guys like that around, guys that will do the dirty work. Accardo was apparently very proud of his violent reputation. He was caught on wiretap years later, boasting about how he had participated in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which occurred in 1929, was the execution of 7 members and associates of the Northside Gang, which was at that time the most powerful Irish gang in Chicago. The feud between the outfit and this Irish gang boiled down to control of bootlegging in the city. The Northsiders were one of the key competitors to the outfit. On the morning of February 14, 2029, the 7 men were lined up and shot in a garage on Chicago's North Side. The prime target was likely George Bugs Moran, leader of the Northside gang. Moran was not at the garage at the time of the shooting. He had been held up and arrived just after it occurred. But the details of the incident are wild. Two of the shooters apparently impersonated police officers and ordered the Irishman to line up against the wall of the garage. All four shooters then opened up with machine guns and shotguns. All of the men were killed instantly except for one. He was still alive when Chicago police arrived and he was actually conscious. Police and then later the doctors asked him if he knew who had shot him and he refused to say, he just said, "Nobody shot me." The explanation for the attack can be traced back to the hijacking of Capone's liquor shipments from out of state. Apparently it was well known throughout the underworld that the Northsiders had been hijacking these shipments to steal Capone's booze, so this made Capone the prime suspect in the murder. He was in Florida at the time, but that doesn't necessarily matter. It's not like he was going to go out there and carry out the act himself anyway. There was a massive investigation into the shooting, and several people close to Capone were implicated. Ultimately, nobody was ever convicted for it. Several of the people who were implicated in it were murdered by, allegedly by Capone, and others got off for various reasons. While nobody was convicted, the incident did bring a lot of extra attention on the outfit and on Capone himself. It remains up in the air whether Accardo was one of the shooters, and many sources claim that he was not, and that when he was caught on wiretap, that was just bluster. Regardless, Accardo was quickly rising up the ranks of the outfit. That much could not be disputed. Al Capone started to face a lot of legal troubles in the late 1920s and early 1930s. For much of the 20s, he was actually fairly well regarded by the public. He donated to charities and even opened up a soup kitchen in the city. And further, he would go in and serve soup himself from time to time. But the St. Valentine's Day massacre shattered this image. The people of Chicago started to realize the kind of man he truly was. They could generally look the other way, but seven men being killed in broad daylight in such a brutal manner was hard to stomach. In 1930, Capone was named Public Enemy Number 1 by the Chicago Crime Commission. Side note, but Accardo would end up on this list as well. Capone served 6 months in jail in 1929 and 1930 for weapons charges, and another 6 months in 1931 for contempt of court. Around this same time, the federal government, specifically the Treasury Department, had started working on a tax evasion case against Capone and other members of the outfit. Capone never filed tax returns. He didn't even really try to hide this. He just claimed that he had no taxable income. He would later be quoted saying something to the effect of, "How can they take taxes from illegal money?" But IRS agents were able to build evidence showing that Capone had made millions, and obviously he never reported any of it. During negotiations, he agreed to a plea deal under which he would serve 2 years in prison, but he got a little too cocky about this and started bragging. The judge didn't like this and had other plans and refused to accept the plea deal. Capone was ultimately found guilty of tax evasion in October 1931 and sentenced to 11 years in prison. Just like that, one of the most notorious gangsters in history was put away, and the Chicago outfit suddenly had an opening for its top job. Tony Accardo was certainly a well-respected member of the outfit, but he did not take over as boss immediately. That's really not surprising. He was still very young at this point, and even though he had shown that he was loyal and very capable, he just didn't have the time in necessary to rise to that level yet. However, he was made a captain and given his own crew by the new boss, Frank Nitti. This change in leadership wasn't the only blow to the outfit in the 30s. Prohibition ended in 1933, and with it, the outfit's number one money-making operation dried up. They adapted quickly and moved into other areas, including illegal gambling and loan sharking, and of course, labor racketeering. That last one is what ended up causing the most problems for them. In the early 40s, multiple high-ranking members were looking at serious jail time for labor racketeering involving Hollywood movie studios. You might be asking yourself, what in the hell were Chicago gangsters doing out in Hollywood? And the answer was, they were following the money. Nitti had become aware of an extortion scheme involving movie crew unions and quickly wanted his piece. And when I say wanted his piece, he basically told the criminals running at the time that, hey, we're taking this over. The mobsters took over the unions, which represented essential employees in the process of movie making. They would then threaten the studios with massive strikes if they didn't pay up. And it worked. They were able to take in millions with this scheme. But eventually, their luck ran out and it was time to pay the consequences. Frank Nitti, who was still the boss, committed suicide in 1943. He had been to jail prior to this, and apparently it was a horrible experience for him, and he just wasn't willing to do it again. Paul Rica, who had largely been running the day-to-day operations of the organization anyway, officially became boss and promoted Accardo to the number two position as underboss. Paul Rica has a fascinating story. He was born in Naples and was involved in organized crime there as a young man. He killed a man when he was just a teenager, allegedly for mistreating his sister. He was convicted and served a short stint in prison. Shortly after getting out, he killed another guy. Apparently this was in retaliation for the guy testifying against him at his first murder trial. After this, Rica was feeling the heat and decided to flee for the United States, and he ended up in New York in 1920. He eventually made his way to Chicago and started working as a transporter of bootlegged liquor. He also worked at a high-end restaurant where he earned his nickname, The Waiter. The restaurant was also a hangout for many top mobsters, and Rica eventually made his way into their crews. Rica quickly impressed Capone, and they became close friends. By the time Capone went to prison, Rica was on the fast track to becoming boss. He was so well respected, it's not hard to see why the general consensus is that he was actually running things day to day and not nitty. Rica eventually went to jail for the Hollywood racketeering scheme that I talked about earlier, and Accardo was named acting boss. In 1946, the Havana Conference was held in Havana, Cuba. This was a massive meeting of the top mafia figures in the United States. Accardo was part of the group representing Chicago at this meeting.
The meeting was set up to discuss pressing issues facing the mafia at that time. Charles Lucky Luciano was the headliner. Luciano is one of the most important figures in the history of organized crime. He was responsible for setting up the commission in 1931. Up until that point, the final voice of authority in the mafia was given to just one man. Luciano believed everybody would benefit from setting up a council of sort, where the bosses of the top families would work together to make decisions. As part of a plea deal with the federal government, Luciano was deported in 1946, but he retained enormous influence in the United States. I won't go into a ton of detail about the Havana Conference, but the important point is that it was a meeting of the most powerful mobsters in the country, discussing the most important issues to the mafia at that time, and Accardo was in attendance.
Accardo was named official boss of the outfit in 1947. This was largely due to Rica being ordered by the courts not to interact with known criminals. Rica still served as a gangster consultant of sorts, working behind the scenes to help Accardo run things. And the two men together ran the outfit for the next 3 decades. The fact that they were able to successfully share this power is somewhat incredible when you think about it. They lived in a life where you constantly had to look over your shoulder and wonder which of your so-called friends was going to take you out for their own personal gain. And this wouldn't be the last time that Accardo demonstrated his willingness to share the spotlight and work with others. While Paul Rica certainly had a lot of influence, Accardo did have control over the day-to-day operations of the outfit during his tenure as boss. Under his leadership, the group became heavily involved in a number of industries, including vending machines and drug trafficking. Accardo also made the decision to slowly move the group out of higher risk operations like labor racketeering and extortion. I would guess that the outcome of the Hollywood extortion scheme had something to do with this. The investigation into that scheme decimated the leadership of the outfit, and so it made sense to move into things where there'd be a little bit less heat on them. The area where Accardo made the most gains was in gambling. He seized control of the wire services that were used to carry racing information. This allowed him to help his bookmakers with odds and money collection. He was also instrumental in the mafia control of Las Vegas. In the 50s and 60s, the outfit had an interest, or even outright control of, many casinos, including the Riviera, the Flamingo, and the Stardust. The outfit would retain its interest in Vegas for decades. An indictment in the early 80s showed that they were heavily involved in the skimming operations at the Tropicana Hotel and Casino in the 70s. It also showed that they had worked hand-in-hand with a number of other families, including Kansas City, Cleveland, and Milwaukee. Accardo didn't just build up gambling operations away from home. He also greatly expanded the outfit's rackets in Chicago as well. He oversaw literally thousands of different gambling operations in Chicago. Card games, pool halls, sports betting operations, you name it, he was involved with it. The changes made by Accardo and the new ventures he led them into allowed the outfit to flourish during the changing times. Despite having served as one of his top men, Accardo was very different from Al Capone. Capone did not mind being in the spotlight. He loved that people thought of him as something of a Robin Hood. Accardo, on the other hand, preferred to operate from the shadows. He was perfectly fine if nobody on the outside knew he was in charge. In fact, he probably preferred it this way. He could put someone else into a position of power, and they would take the heat off of him while he was able to run things quietly. He didn't drive lavish cars, he didn't spend his time out at clubs, he preferred to just do his business and go home to his family. It wasn't all smooth going all the time for Accardo. He was forced to testify in front of the Kefauver Committee in the Senate in 1951. This committee was tasked with investigating organized crime in the United States. During his testimony, he invoked the Fifth Amendment 140 times, essentially refusing to talk about anything. He was held in contempt of Congress, but this didn't go anywhere in the courts. Accardo stepped down as boss officially in 1957 for the same reasons Eureka had earlier, increased heat on the family and on himself. Accardo was particularly worried about the heat from the federal government in regards to his taxes. Now, as I stated earlier, Eureka and Accardo ran the outfit together for 30 years, so Accardo stepping down in 1957 doesn't really line up with that. The math doesn't check out. But the reality is that while they allowed others to take the title of boss, Accardo and Eureka still ran the show behind the scenes. They were pulling all the strings. Nothing was done without their approval. This was confirmed multiple times by various sources, including by the Chicago Crime Commission in 1961, when they stated Accardo was still the head of the outfit. Further evidence that he was still in charge was his attendance at the Apalachin meeting shortly after stepping down as boss. He was accompanied by Sam Giancana, the man Accardo and Eureka had installed as boss. Both men were able to avoid being arrested at the meeting. If Accardo wanted someone to be the lightning rod to protect himself, Giancana was the perfect choice. He was pretty much the opposite of Accardo and Eureka when it came to how he presented himself. Accardo and Eureka were more old school, laid back, preferred to operate in the shadows. If you didn't know any better, you would have thought they were just ordinary guys. This was not the case with Giancana. He wanted everyone to know he was powerful. He lived a flashy lifestyle, going to nightclubs, throwing his money around. To make matters worse, there were allegations that Giancana did not properly share the profits from casino operations that he was overseeing. Accardo and Eureka made the decision to replace him in 1966. His high-profile demeanor had brought too much heat on the organization. They installed another boss, but again, this was really only in name. Accardo and Eureka still ran the outfit. They still made all of the high-level decisions. Paul Eureka died in 1972. This meant that Accardo sat alone atop the outfit's power structure. He was the top dog and had ultimate say in all important matters. It does appear that Accardo took a somewhat more limited role around this time, and he began to spend a lot of his time in California. However, it's also known that he would fly back to Chicago frequently for high-level meetings and to take care of things.
It was around this time, in January 1978 specifically, that another crazy incident involving Accardo took place. Accardo was out in California when his house back in suburban Chicago was burglarized. This was apparently carried out by outfit members who felt disrespected by Accardo after he made them return stolen jewelry to a store they had robbed. The owner was friends with Accardo. The leader of this crew was John Mendel. Mendel thought that breaking into Accardo's house was the correct response. Big mistake. Mendel was found dead in the trunk of his car a few weeks later, and the rest of his crew was living on borrowed time. The six other members were all killed within a few months. Three additional outfit members who were actually on Accardo's side and had helped carry out the hits on Mendel's crew were murdered as well. This was an effort by Accardo to cover his tracks. If there was any doubt about the power Accardo still had at that point in his life, here's your answer. His house was burglarized, and within a few months, all of those responsible were dead.
This is probably a good time to mention another interesting thing about Accardo, and that's his ability to avoid jail time. While he was arrested on numerous occasions, he only spent one night in jail in his entire life. Think about that for a second. The man who was heavily involved and even led for a number of years one of the most powerful criminal organizations in history never did any time. He had likely murdered or at least ordered the murder of countless people. He had run illegal gambling operations all over the country, and he still managed to avoid serious trouble. Moving on to a little bit more of the personal side here, Accardo had married Clarice Porzani in 1934. They had four children together, two girls and two boys who they had adopted. One of his daughters, named Marie, married Palmer Pyle, who was a professional football player. Their son also played in the league. Their daughter Cheryl married John Bosa, who also played in the NFL. Cheryl's two sons, Nick and Joey Bosa, are both currently star pass rushers in the NFL. The Bosa brothers never met Accardo, but Joey Bosa did say the following to the Chicago Tribune. Quote, "I've only heard amazing things about him. Wish I could have spent some time with him before he passed." By the later part of his life, Accardo had moved into a lot of legitimate businesses and had a lot of illegal investments. This includes in factories, office buildings, distribution centers, trucking companies, restaurants, and even travel agencies. He spent the last part of his life in Illinois living with his daughter and son-in-law. On May 22, 1992, Tony Accardo died at the age of 86. Tony Accardo is a fascinating study for many reasons. He was one of the most powerful people in the United States for decades, but he never really acted like it. He was on the one hand known for being a brutally violent mobster, and on the other, a family man in his later years. He was one of Al Capone's top men, and went on to be a top voice in the Chicago outfit for many years. Thank you for listening to episode 4 of The Mob Files. If you enjoyed, please be sure to subscribe, and if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. Thanks again, and have a great day.